Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 402nd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta and the Director of Program and Practice Support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada.
And so this is our third podcast on trying to prove to the outside world that we're not therapeutic nihilists.
Right, and bring some sunshine and lollipops to an otherwise dark and dismal world.
You know, and I'm thinking Order of Canada here. if not just sainthood. So let's see if we can attain that with you guys. So in the previous podcast, I'm not going to go over them. We talked a lot about medications for risk reduction, and hopefully we did a reasonable job of that. But now we want to delve into the area of people who actually have symptoms, and can we make them feel better? We're just going to do a bunch of random different ones. And Mike, why don't you start?
Right. So let's jump into this. So a lot of the things we see in primary care, as it turns out, things like cystitis, they occur very commonly. We see a lot of it. And a good reminder for us and there are intervention trials where they don't give antibiotics for cystitis. And there's just one published now comparing ibuprofen, and patients who got antibiotics did better. So let's talk about overall, what's it like if you treat bacterial bladder infections? And the number needed to treat there is kind of 2 to 3, depending on what your other interventions are and that kind of thing. But, you know, we're talking about 50% plus benefiting over placebo. And some people will get better with a bladder infection.
Most of the time when they look at the benefit, it's at about the 3-day course. And so if you're wondering sort of what some of the numbers are, in those placebo-controlled trials, about 25 to 50% on placebo
get better.
Were better at the 3, you know, and in how you define better. But then you get that additional, you know, maybe 30 or 40 or maybe even 50% absolute benefit on top of that.
Right.
If you give antibiotics. And so, and we're not talking about, you know, mortality benefits. We're not even talking about reduction of, you know, pyelonephritis or any of those things, just symptomatic.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people who have a cystitis episode and can't go to work, can't focus.
Oh, it's just horrible, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like I've heard people say, I'm peeing razor blades. And that, I haven't had that happen to me, but it can't be fun.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, if you're out of razor blades, it helps. But
and then things like, you know, just simple IND, incision and drainage of a cutaneous abscess. We do that in the office quite regularly. What percent of patients will be improved at 10 days? And complete resolution is found in 86% of patients with that simple maneuver. And we know now that if you add in things like antibiotics to some of the more aggressive ones, that's only going to augment that with a number needed to treat of 10 kind of on top of your IND. Let's talk about tinea pedis, so the good old foot fungus. So how many, with just a topical treatment, 70% of patients will be resolved. Now, some of that, again, was due to a natural evolution of disease and that it resolving itself, but the number needed to treat there is still somewhere around 2 to 3. So a lot of patients overall getting better.
Yeah.
And the last one is otitis media. So otitis media has got a bad rap in the last little while about we shouldn't treat otitis media. And I think what's lost in that and what I find frustrating in these kind of we shouldn't do this or we should do that is the nuance of who's the patient in front of you. So the 12-year-old who's in your office with a red tympanic membrane who maybe says, yeah, it feels a little sore from time to time and they have a cold, that kid does not need antibiotics. But the, you know, the 18-month-old who's in daycare with fever and those kind of more severe symptoms, we know that those kids will actually get benefit from treating otitis media. And so the number needed to treat for them is in that 3 to 4 range.
And it's obviously it's clear that that's the sort of the benefit, but also, you know, you don't, as a clinician, you don't want to go down the path of, boy, it would have been nice if I would have used antibiotics. You know, we all worry about that.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, the threshold that we use for things to do with infections, you know, there much of, and I'm going to get in trouble with my ID colleagues, but much of ID is, you know, hocus pocus and witchcraft and all that sort of stuff. Because, you know, there's not a lot of good studies, for instance, like in pneumonia, saying one antibiotic is better than another antibiotic. Antibiotics are a benefit and that sort of stuff. But, you know, the decision to use antibiotics is not simply based on the best available evidence.
Yeah.
In a really sick person, you're going to use, you know, bigger
doses. You're going to gravitate towards using sooner.
Yeah. You're going to use maybe two antibiotics.
Right. Or even, or just higher doses and all of those things, right?
And
we know higher doses, shorter periods are better in most cases in antibiotics.
Exactly.
Not always, but most.
And so that's where, you know, we take some of the evidence and use the art of medicine and contextualize it for them. And I think, so not only is it important to deal with our fears, is then also discussing with patients of, if things go south,
right.
And what does going south mean?
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean going to Mexico. It means, you know, it means that the kid and or the person in front of you is getting worse. And how do you identify whether it's worse? And what is worse? And what's the expectation of how much better you should get? Because, you know, even with the treatment of cystitis, one of the main, there is reasonably good evidence that single dose works.
Mm-hmm.
It's not used much in primary care.
And 3 days, I think, is I remember going. I remember being the 7 to 10 day person and going to 3 days and feeling like, I don't know what I'm doing to you, but God, I hope you do better.
Because
you're just terrified to make that shift, even though the evidence shows it. That big a shift from 7 to 10 days to 3 was a huge jump.
But there is single dose, and I think one of the main reasons, and I this is all anecdotal, is that the reason we don't go to single dose, even though it's been shown to be as good as 3 days, you know, when you use like three double strength Bactrim and that sort of stuff, is that they will not be necessarily better at 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have a person who's, you've given antibiotics to, they no longer have any more antibiotics, and then they're going to phone you and annoy you. And I think that's why you don't do it, right, Mike?
There's a host of reasons. It's, again, that comfort, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm an evidence-based person generally, but it takes some time to make a full adjustment to practice.
Yeah, so there's, like I said, especially when it comes to infectious disease, there's a lot of, you know...
I remember one of your speakers one time at the PS Medicine Conference was, you often get ID speakers, and one of them, we were asking the questions around, but how do you reconcile the fact that antibiotics that shouldn't work because the cultured bacterium we find out later is resistant, but the antibiotics still worked in reducing the infection and curing the clinical illness. Yeah,
the don't know if it was the antibiotic, but they got better.
But they got better, and I was like, how do you reconcile this confusion with culture results? And she said the exact quote was something along the lines of, "You're messing with my very career."
So
I didn't get a clear answer, but even ID, many of them recognize that there's a conundrum, a kind of a confusion to this whole culture thing versus results.
But and we're not saying that cultures are not necessarily useful. I mean, there's actually a number of places where they're not useful, like repeat cultures for cystitis and stuff.
Right.
We know that. But, you know, we're almost doing it as an insurance policy. We're going, we think the person's really sick.
Right, and we're hoping this antibiotic is the magic one, but what if it's not, and this person is sick 2 days from now?
Then what can we use to guide us, and that sort of stuff? So, and you know, we've talked a lot about this when it comes to infections, about, you know, are the resistance patterns in hospital, what do they have to do with the outside? And almost nothing. and where you're hearing a lot about resistance being a problem is, It's not that there's not an increase in resistance in the community. There is, but we are using antibiotics. We should be using antibiotics in a very, very similar way we did 30 or 40 years ago in the community for people who are not really, really, really ill.
Right.
It's where we run into major problems is, you know, the intensive care units where we're seeing, you know, basically bugs just laughing at all the antibiotics and that sort of stuff. So that's the issue within. But you know, when it comes to infections, we are. I mean, no one needs to tell anyone listening to this podcast that antibiotics have a role in medicine, and it would be a very sad day if we didn't have any of them.
Right.
And we spend a lot of time talking about, you know, the duration and you know, how you can get the person
optimizing
it.
And I think we're still there. We're still need to work on that a little bit more, but we've come a long way. And antibiotics, I don't think there's a single person alive who would say that they're not a significant impact on longevity and comfort of humans, because
And speaking of something that's really, really useful, I mean, corticosteroids.
They're, and so as someone with atopy, with asthma and eczema and all of that stuff, I can give a testimonial. But instead of that, high-level evidence, we're going to drop to the lower-level evidence of randomized controlled trials.
You always go this route.
And for acute asthma, a short course of oral steroids has a number needed to treat of 10 to prevent relapse within 7 days. Mm-hmm. And a common use, and certainly in, and we've advocated this before because of its risk-benefit profile is so good, the steroid injections of the knee, number needed to treat 2 to 4, depending on the duration. So what might that look like? Well, about 75% getting better at 2 weeks versus 45% in the placebo arm. Mm-hmm. The placebo injection is a very powerful injection because something is going into that magic joint space and doing something. So it's very, and it's a pain, as you know, is susceptible to the placebo effect. Mm-hmm. True.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I'll just, you know, some personal experience for myself with some issues to do with shoulders.
Yeah.
I mean, over the last few years, I've had both my shoulders are hurting, and I've done the rehab and it just doesn't do anything. I'm not the most adherent person when it comes to rehab.
No.
I know it's hard to believe. So I think it's important that we realize that one of the highest levels of evidence is that if nothing works, you know, if there's a pain that's there all the time and nothing has worked, and then you do something and it works, you know, within a day or two, it likely was that.
Yeah.
And I, as I was saying, I was going to talk about, you know, the example of my shoulders. I had a struggle with, you know, I played a lot of sports and I damaged my rotator cuff a bit and it never got better. And in both shoulders, I had injections of steroids, and within 24 to 48 hours, where I'd had discomfort and pain for a year, it was gone.
Yeah. And that's classic.
And I'm not saying it could have been placebo. Or maybe it's injecting that area with a needle and putting fluid in. I don't know. And honest to God, I can't tell you how little I care.
Yeah.
I care that it got better. And so those are real examples that we do have to appreciate that evidence is actually real.
Yeah.
And we do need RCTs to put it into the context of does it work. But then you also have to stand back and go, what's the harm? I mean, you know, if you're talking about doing things like arthroplasty, there's a clear cost and harm to it. But the simple context of an injection of a steroid, I mean, there's...
In certain areas, we know that it worsens long-term recovery.
Yes.
But in the short term, most places you inject are better. And in your example, James, it's like if we take... There's been trials where we've actually taken steroids and injected it into people's buttocks and versus the shoulder and found that it really doesn't matter. It's that steroid that matters.
Yeah, and if you happen to be a person who's a pain in the ass, it works as well.
Yeah, but I would say to people that, you know, for those of us who worry, am I actually getting into the right AC, the AC joint, into the bursa, whatever you like, it probably doesn't matter. Well, the AC joint isn't where you'd go anyway, but if you am I getting into the bursa? Well, what matters is, did you put steroid in there somewhere?
Yeah, and it's my understanding, and again, just personal experience, it's not so much getting it into, it's around it.
Yeah.
And again, we talked about the magic of infections mm-hmm. and antibiotics. Corticosteroid has its own level of magic in this.
For sure.
And the risk is, I mean, you can clearly get abscesses or you can get, you know, local site infections and things like that, but they're relatively uncommon.
Yeah.
And the cost of these is almost nothing. Like almost nothing relative to the two. So our threshold should be much less. But we also have evidence, you know, for corticosteroids for other things as well.
Right. So things like nasal sprays, we often kind of forget about that. We think antibiotics are going to fix rhinosinusitis that's prolonged, but actually corticosteroid nasal sprays, number needed to treat of 5 mm-hmm. for chronic rhinosinusitis. For rheumatoid arthritis flares. Now here we're using a whole bunch of different scales for rheumatoid arthritis. Mm-hmm. So we have to pool them together in something called a standard mean difference. But I think, James, as someone who looks at these, when you hear a standard mean difference of 1.75 or 1.1, you know that those are big differences.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you see that in almost nothing.
Right. And this is with prednisone of 15 milligrams or less.
Yeah. And so, you know, I have some family members and I'm sure you know lots of people and I know other patients who use these agents. And I think, you know, my threshold for advising people to use prednisone for when their arthritis gets bad is not that high. It's you know, because the risk of using prednisone for a week or so, you know, every, you know, 8-9 months, I'm not sure.
I don't know what it is, but then that tapering dose of going a month, like now for a lot of things, they kind of give this low, slow taper. But it's not for what we think of as preventing the adverse events of steroids. As much as that, it's kind of allowing that sustained. And then a lot of the time when they're having these relapses, it's a reminder we need better long-term therapies for them. But the small doses of prednisone are used often as part of kind of chronic therapy for patients in rheumatoid arthritis in places like Europe and that. And there are benefits for these patients. But in these acute flares, as you're insinuating or talking about, they can have quite a dramatic effect.
Oh yeah, and again, lots of people ask me, so, well, how much should I use? I haven't got a freaking clue. I mean, I don't know the right dose.
But you don't need a lot.
You don't need the 60 or 80 milligrams.
No.
You know, if you can, and you know, how long should you use it before you stop? I don't know. But you don't want to be on steroids for months.
No.
And, you know.
In a perfect world, you sure don't.
Yeah. And if you, no, I mean, some people have to be. This, you know, I remember a patient at St. Paul's Hospital who had, you know, just literally the worst asthma I've ever heard of. And they just went around with, you know, with basically IV steroids constantly and IV salbutamol. And that's, they just walked around with that. That's what they needed to breathe. And so, you know, often when we're talking about like, how long do you use it? I mean, it's tricky.
It is.
You know, we don't know exactly the way to do it. I think typically one does taper it.
Yeah.
And it's not tapering it to prevent the side effects, if you will. And everybody, even if we had a randomized controlled trial showing that you need to taper it this way and that way, it's going to be very patient individualized.
And based on other treatment options available for that patient.
Exactly.
Maybe that patient has been someone who's refused to take methotrexate, et cetera, in the past, but now had 3 flares in a year that really do indicate it's time to consider other treatment options.
No, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, and the whole point of us, we're not going to go into the whole discussion of all of the evidence around rheumatoid arthritis. That's a lot of stuff. But just that corticosteroids have a place.
Yeah.
And a really important place.
Right. Let's move on to mental health, because we've talked a little bit about this already, but we haven't really talked about some of the nuances of it. And antidepressant therapy does have some benefits. So in patients with kind of moderate to severe, with mild, the number needed to treat creep up into the kind of 20, because these patients are often going to get better if you do nothing at all.
And some people suggest in the mild, there's almost may not be anything in the mild.
Yeah, in the truly mild. In the moderate, maybe number needed to treat is 15. In the moderate to severe range, so these would be the quite sick patients in our practices, the number needed to treat are somewhere around 10. But in very severe patients, HAM-D scores north of 23, so quite profoundly sick, their number needed to treat could be as good as 5 and 4.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's because there's good evidence that as the condition worsens, the placebo effect declines.
Mm-hmm.
The drug effect stays the same, kind of 50 to 60% getting better.
Mm-hmm.
But the placebo effect starts to go down, making the absolute
Well, not the placebo effect, but the chance that they will be better if
in the placebo group.
Yeah.
It goes down, and therefore we're seeing a bigger effect.
And so there was a recent meta-analysis saying, you know, we've finally shown that antidepressants work. And, you know, which again, it's not a matter of do they work or not. What it is, we want to know whether they do have an effect. I mean, yeah, I think the evidence is overwhelming. They have an effect.
Right.
On average, more than placebo. And the issue is the magnitude. I'm not going to be self-promotion. Tina and I did a commentary in the BMJ a little while ago where we go over a lot of what we already talked about, Mike. But you've got to know what's the chance of a benefit in the placebo group. And if you don't know that, I don't know how you can actually... It's really difficult to practice medicine if you're trying to figure out, did your treatment do anything?
Right. Well, and it was exactly what we talked about on the very first podcast. You will notice in your practice that the results do not mirror what we're reporting from clinical trials. Mm-hmm. So a number needed to treat of 10, when you know that half of the patients you give it to seem to get better, that actually take it. And you'll say to yourself, well, heck, how does that happen? How can you get 1 in every 2 patients getting better, but the number needed to treat is 1 in every 10?
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the number in the placebo group, et cetera, the natural progress of this disease is people are going to get better in that 8-week to 10-week period. So how much more did the drug give you over and above?
And for depression, you can it's an easy relative number. You can go 40% will get better on in the placebo group, and you add another 10% from the drug.
Yeah, exactly. It's about one in every two patients will get better over 8 to 10 weeks.
Yeah, and if the patient gets better, it was because of the medication in one of five.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Of those who got better.
Of those who got better.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's just wrap up with pain, because I think that's something we see, and we've got to, talking of self-promotion, we've got a tool out called Comparing Treatment Options in Pain, and the other way to look at it is Pain Calculator, pain-calculator, if you search under that. But it'll tell you for neuropathic pain all the treatment options, and within a couple months we'll probably be adding in some for osteoarthritis as well. But just to give you some example of pain treatments that we have that can result in benefit. So getting kind of a moderate or a 50% pain reduction. Number needed to treat is often kind of 4 to 10 range for things like TCAs and gabapentin and that kind of thing in the neuropathic, for neuropathic pain. When we're talking about TCAs for headache, and the good thing about TCAs is they take any kind of headache and improve the recurrence of that. And so this is a reduction in the frequency of headaches over usually a month period. Number needed to treat there is 8. So you have to treat 8 people. And again, a huge number, a much bigger number than 1 in 8 will actually have a reduction in headaches. But how many are due to the TCA?
Yeah, and the number that I sort of think about is, and this is you said headache prevention, right? This is not if you have a headache.
Yeah, no, this is short term.
Yeah. And so and there's various scales that they use. And so the numbers I kind of remember in my head is sort of, if you give placebo, about 25% of people will get a 50% reduction in their pain or frequency of their headaches. And then if you give a treatment, it goes up to about 50%.
Right.
So instead of a quarter benefiting. So the nice thing again is if you give one of these agents, 50% of the patients will come back and say,
I'm better.
Say you're a genius.
Yeah. No one has ever said that to me, ever.
Really?
Yeah.
That's sad because, it's constant for me.
Yeah. It's a funny thing.
Or is that maybe only in my dreams? I'm not sure. It's so confusing sometimes. reality and
and myth.
And myth is so... It
blurs.
It blurs so much. So those are the sorts of numbers you can think about for, headache prevention. But again, if a person tells you that they benefited, it's a 50-50 chance that it wasn't the drug. And so how do you... So then...
Discern that.
Yeah.
It's difficult. Many patients will be willing to do a trial of, maybe I can come off after a while, or others will say, no, this is life-saving. I don't want to risk it.
Yeah.
And then if it's specifically migraine-type headaches, propranolol and some of the beta blockers are good choices. Number needed to treat 4 for that. So, and then, things like NSAIDs and muscle relaxants and back pain, this is particularly short-term. It's number needed to treat 6 to 8 kind of thing. And that's just for pain relief. There's that great trial of naproxen versus a whole bunch of different interventions. And naproxen was just as good as anything else. So, including... low potency opioids. So again, there's a lot of things we can do for pain. Is it something where, short of general anesthesia, we can take people who are in a lot of pain and turn it into 0?
Yeah, no.
No. But can we make a difference for them? The research consistently shows that we can.
And we can say that these drugs in our sort of definition work.
Right.
But in general, most people don't get a benefit.
Right.
But enough that we go, it's worth a try. As long as they tolerate it.
Most people don't get a benefit that's clearly just from the drug itself.
Yeah. And then, there's a number of other... Are we done with pain? Is there anything else you want to talk about with pain?
No,
yeah.
That's good.
So, there's a few other things that I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about. Proton pump inhibitors is an example. There is no doubt they work.
They are... And so it is interesting because the harms from proton pump inhibitors generally come from large cohort studies, which are susceptible to biases.
Yeah.
But the benefits come from RCTs and are very clear.
Yeah. And their numbers needed to treat are 2, which you get a 50% reduction in the number of people who have symptoms at 8 weeks.
And that's like a 90% of patients will feel better on a PPI with a GERD symptom.
Yeah.
Versus, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's kind of 40 to 60 for H2 blockers, histamine blockers.
Yeah.
And then it's 25 to 30
for
placebo. So that number needed to treat of 2 is rare in medicine.
Yeah.
But PPIs are one of those. And that's why patients love them, because they do really work. And when they try and withdraw from them, as you know, there is evidence that if you're healthy, don't even have GERD. We put you on a PPI and then pull you off. You'll get GERD.
Yeah, about 10% of people will get it from that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And talk about drugs that people love. I mean, the erectile dysfunction drugs. I mean, the sildenafil, again, if you want the numbers needed to treat for those, it's 2.
Yeah.
You know, for people who are profound.
Number needed to harm for headache, 4.
Yeah.
Number needed to stop. 0.
0. Yeah. Exactly. And as we talked about on previous podcasts, I always love the, you know, the end point is successful intercourse. And I don't even know how you define that. Maybe you can draw me a picture later, Mike.
Yeah, that's right. We'll go through the basics. Some of the books that I showed my kids when they were young.
Exactly, yeah.
But what are mommy and daddy doing?
When you walked in the bedroom. And, you know, and the reason that, again, the benefit is that, you know, people with profound, if you will, erectile dysfunction, the placebo is you get like 5% of people, you know, actually having successful intercourse, and you can bump that up to about 50%. So again, it's not everybody that's benefiting from it and those sorts of things. But, you know, we have all sorts of, you know, medications, and about 2 or 3 years ago, we went through what are the medications that we would hate if we didn't have.
Yeah, you know, we would take to the desert island.
Yeah,
kind of
and
thing.
It's the, you know, it's the salbutamols, it's the insulins and all those drugs. And they're all incredibly effective.
Right.
And they work in.
Exactly. Because we just said a few moments ago in the other podcast that one of the problems with insulin is that it doesn't really affect heart outcomes, mm-hmm. particularly macrovascular outcomes, may affect microvascular based on a few, some UKPDS data. But what it absolutely does is reduce sugars. And when sugars are getting very high and you want to affect people's symptomatic, give them a symptomatic benefit, it can consistently do that.
Yeah. And most of the time we're talking about type 1s.
Yeah. But, well, and for them, it's a profound effect.
Yeah, that's right? What I'm saying. Like that's where the effect is profound.
Yeah. But in the there, you know, I don't want to wade into the micro macrovascular because I haven't read it near as much as the type 2s. But
the DCCT trials and all those.
Yeah, all that stuff. Exactly. Where there was benefits. But in the type 2s, what we're really talking about is those who have gone, as you put, south to Mexico, mm-hmm. and their A1Cs are getting quite high.
Yeah. And you know, the you know, sleeping pills have an effect,
right?
But you know, the improvement in, and I'm not just about how quickly, but if you have an improvement in sleep quality, we're still talking about numbers needed to treat of 13, which again means the vast majority don't.
Right.
And as we talk about symptoms, you know, with the exception of PPI, sildenafil, and anesthesia, the majority of people are not benefiting from them. And I, you know, I would be very remiss if you, at this point, Mike, if I didn't go into the issue of low dose. Don't you think? Because low dose works.
Yeah. And did, I don't know how many of you had it, but on 403, you've heard it here first.
Yes, so you've never heard this concept. But if in fact, and
well, 402, it's four podcast 402.
Yeah.
It just feels like, because
like,
you brought
it
up.
It feels like 8:39.
Yeah.
And again, there's two reasons why I push the concept of low dose. One, there's a lot of RCTs showing lower doses give you equal benefit to much higher doses. And there's a whole mechanism of action, if you will. And I'm almost not mechanism of action, but also the problem with the whole FDA and Health Canada approval process, you have to study very large doses to show it has an effect in enough people that you can statistically show it, which means lots of people will get better with lower doses. But even that aside, when we just went through the process of symptomatic control, you can appreciate that the majority of people are not getting benefit, and there's a reasonable placebo group effect. Why not start with low doses? You know, because you're going to get all that placebo joy, if you will, with the lower doses. Now, it comes back to a very similar approach, though, with, and I think you'd agree with me, Mike, when it comes to infectious diseases. If they're really sick, you give good doses and maybe 3 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, if you have a person who's severely depressed, if you have a person who has terrible glucose or whatever it is, you're going to use the doses that most people use and be aggressive with it and so on. But when it's not life-threatening, you just don't want to do harm because you get less side effects with lower doses.
And for those tuning in, you might, if you ever meet James at a cocktail party, you see him at a theater, wherever, don't go up and say hi to him because he's going to talk about this with you.
No, if I'm at a cocktail party, I will be not using low doses of alcohol.
But he's going to like, when you bring your popcorn at the movie theater, are you having that in low dose?
Yes, I am that strange. Yes, that is not true at all. And almost everything that Mike says about me during the podcast is not true, other than the nice things. So as much as we can, we're giving you some ideas of the benefit of drugs for people who are symptomatic, and try to give you some thoughts about how to think about those sorts of things. And we got one more final podcast in this Why We're Not Therapeutic Nihilist approach, right. And we're going to talk about what?
And we're gonna wax poetically and philosophically about our role in healthcare system and in primary care in general.
We're gonna should we do it with a Shakespearean spin? To it?
Yeah, it'll be in prose.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that because I've never understood Shakespeare, and I may not understand that podcast. So as always, we would love it if you check out all of the things that we have on our website. With the links to the tools of practice, which are coming out on a regular basis, the videos, we have our Best Science Medicine course, and by the time you hear this podcast, it'll be just a few months away. That's going to be May 3 and 4. We've just about finalized the people who are coming to that, and Mike might be there. We've got a few other, you know, irons in the fire.
Yeah, got a couple other fish on the hook.
Exactly.
See who you can reel in, and then if desperate, you can turn and bring me back to you.
Because, you know, you're not half bad.
After all the people we invited.
Yeah, we got Mike. So I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.